Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, my co-host this week, Chris Cameron, and our guest, sitting in a different chair from usual, Gwyn Sheltimer. Each week, we visit with a local or regional author or other persons involved with writers and readers. We ask our guests to introduce us to their work and to read for us. We like to get a glimpse into their lives, find out what inspires them, what prompts them to write. We are delighted to have Gwyn as our interviewee today. Welcome, Gwyn.
Thank you for having me.
Gwyn Sheltimer is a writing jack of all trades, poetry, fiction, editing, memoir and non-fiction. Retired from many years as a working writer, earning a living from writing newspaper columns, magazine feature articles, fiction editing for a literary journal, ghostwriting non-fiction books, and working as a senior editor and editor for several communication branches in the provincial government, she now lives and writes for pleasure in the village of Trent River. Retirement, however, hasn't slowed the pace. She's still a partner in Writescape, providing editing services, a variety of workshops and masterclasses, and retreats for writers. Through Writescape, Gwyn also blogs regularly. Well, Gwyn, you've done rather too much to fit neatly into an introductory bio. I'm sure I've left out all sorts of important things. When and why did you start writing?
Well, I started as a child. I actually had my first paid publication when I was 14, and I earned the princely sum of £2, which was...
£2? I think that sounds quite generous.
Oh, I thought so too at the time. I did well through school. You know, I won the Rhodes Trustee Essay Prize and things like that. But then I got married and had three children and, you know, work and life and all those good things, and I didn't do any writing. But I guess it niggled at the back of my mind, and finally when my children had grown and gone off to university and into their own lives, I decided to take a creative writing course and see where that would lead. And it has led to today. I was working full-time and complaining that I never had enough time to write. And I guess I learned a valuable lesson that you got to really be careful what you wish for, because through a number of circumstances, I lost my job. And suddenly I had all the time to write. So I decided to put my money where my mouth was and registered a writing business and launched myself into the freelance world.
You said that your work has been richly influenced by your life in Africa and the immigrant experience. Tell us a little about that.
I was born and bred in Zimbabwe, and I left there in 1982 and came to Canada, and it was a real culture shock. You know, I soon got used to it. Canada has very definitely become home. But what I find, which is an interesting thing for a writer, is that I now don't belong in either place. It does have an advantage because I see Canada in many ways as a tourist would. And what you think of as ordinary is new and interesting to me. Everything from language to popular culture, all kinds of things that I knew nothing about. I mean, I had to relearn all the names of the birds and the flowers and the trees, you know, everything. So it became all new to me. And then conversely, when I write about what I think is ordinary life in Africa, readers here in Canada think it's all very exotic and new and different, which it is for them. So I guess that gives me an advantage. The only thing I do find that really sticks with me, though, is I do a lot of my writing from landscape. Like, it really influences what I write. And the African landscape has never left me.
So Africa still has a grip on you, and now you're working again on Savannah Child. Tell us about that novel, or is it a memoir?
Well, it's been both in various drafts, and I think in the end it will be a hybrid. At heart, it is my story, so in a way it's a memoir. And I lived there during the dying days of British colonialism, and then 10-odd years of civil war. So that makes for an interesting background. But the story itself is not about that. It's a personal story. It's a story of relationship. And most of the events that I plan to include or have written about so far have actually happened, but not necessarily to me. And in fact, what I've done is I've taken several real people and I've conflated them into one person here and one person there so that they're a little more interesting and rounded. And I've also created a purely fictional person that I use to kind of knit the stories together. In the end, it is a fiction, but very heavily based on real events.
Okay, I believe you also have completed a children's novel and a mystery novel in progress. It's interesting that your three novels are all quite different, or are they?
Yes, I think they are very different, and I think they're different because they come from different sources. I actually started out my fiction writing short stories, and I did quite well with them. I won some contests, and I got some published in literary journals and anthologies and things. But I found the whole idea of writing a full-length novel very overwhelming. At the same time, my grandson Ryan kept bugging me to write a story for him. So I thought, well, I'll kill two birds with one stone here and I'll write a children's novel because it's so much shorter. I wrote The Secret of Slaughter Island, I think based on the fact that I used to love those kind of stories myself as a kid, mystery stories. And then having completed that one, it was like, okay, I can do this. I can write a novel. So I decided, okay, I'm going to write a novel that has absolutely nothing to do with me. And I like mystery novels myself to read. So that's what I decided to write. So I started a mystery novel called Pies and Ivy.
Pies and Ivy?
Pies and Ivy.
Oh, okay. How do you spell it?
No, well, it's actually P-Y-E-S, which is one of the characters, and Ivy, who's the other character. But obviously, when you say it quickly, it comes out as Poison Ivy. Yeah, just a play on words like most mystery stories.
So perhaps you would like to read to us. What are you going to read?
I thought I would read from one of my short stories. This one is called The Brothers We Are, and it's quite long, so I'm just going to read a piece from out of the middle. Our stick of eight men had been deployed in the Inyala Tribal Trust lands for 20 days now, masquerading as terrorists. We were a mixed group of black and white soldiers, but the white among us had blackened our faces. We all wore captured enemy uniforms and used captured weapons. Thankfully, our deception had been accepted. Through tribal sympathizers, we had gathered valuable information about terrorist operations, and more importantly, we had managed to convince the local terrorist contact man that we were an incoming unit of the Liberation Forces. Soon he would give us information on the whereabouts of other insurgent groups. In fact, our mission was to identify the guerrilla groups in their location and strength and to radio headquarters. A helicopter fire force would then be sent in to destroy them. Earlier, black members of our stick had visited the village and sensed that something was going on. The contact man suggested there were several small groups in the area, but he was not sure where. He seemed over-anxious to give information, and yet he gave nothing really substantial. Watching from my position in the long grass just beyond the village, I observed an unusual amount of activity. Perhaps there was to be a wedding or a ceremony to summon the tribal spirits. The women were preparing large quantities of sudza, the staple maize dish, and huge earthen pots of fermented doro, beer made from rapoka and corn. Excited chatter rose above the suffocating heat, and somewhere throbbed the heartbeat of a drum. Twilight came with the suddenness of the tropics, and in the half-light I saw the villagers assemble. Drums grew louder, and as the coal-black African night blanketed the felt, voices rose in haunting harmonies. They sang the songs of revolution and raised clenched fists to the sky, copper bangles glinting in the firelight. One by one, members of an insurgent band got up to speak, brandishing AK-47 submachine guns in triumph over their heads and leading the group in hypnotic chanting, "Pamberi Nehondo! Pamberi Nehondo! On with the war!" The crowd responded, and soon it seemed as if the whole valley throbbed. Under cover of darkness, I stood up and carefully advanced. As if of one mind, the whole stick slowly crept through the bush until we were on the edge of the clearing. We could count nearly 20 guerrillas, one sentry each on the right and left flank of the crowd. Two more were displaying their rifles and other weapons to an eager group of small boys. The rest formed an impressive arc in front of the speaker, slightly to the right of the chief's hut. The chief himself sat in a place of honor on a raised dacha bench. Behind the crowd, we could see no guard. It would be necessary now to skirt the village and come up behind the assembly. With practiced stealth, we crept behind the granaries, which formed the outermost circle next to the stockade of thorn scrub branches. Carefully, we passed kitchen huts, sleeping huts, and the ambiza, the children's dormitories. The thatch of the roofs rustled eerily in the night. Cattle and other livestock were corralled at the center of the enclosure for safekeeping, and directly behind this cattle kraal, the villagers pressed forwards, bodies swaying to the beat, enthralled by the masterful oratory of the freedom fighter, his ebony skin shining with sweat and his eyes on fire with passion. We crawled noiselessly through the dry dung of the kraal, and slowly, one by one, we stood up and merged, undetected, into the frenzied crowd. On went the call to revolution, and with a coolness that belied our racing hearts, we eased our way through the group until we were near the front of the throng. The leader continued, still holding his weapon high, and with great dramatic effect, he began the anthem of freedom. A mist of harmonies drifted on the night air. I never heard anything so beautiful. The song ended, and with one voice the audience roared their approval. I knew this was the moment I must not miss. Silently, slowly, steadily, I lifted my rifle to my shoulder and took aim. The world around me moved in slow motion as I squeezed the trigger and watched the leader fall like a felled tree to the dust.
Thank you, Gwyn. We've been speaking with Gwyn Sheltimer about her novels and short stories. Now we'll take a short break.